tune out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Friday the 20th of February 2026, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Yes, it's Friday once again. We've reached the end of the week, and that means I have my co-host with me today. We have Grandpa Dan to listen to today, all the way from Texas. Grandpa, how are you doing, sir? How is life treating you?
Well, we're just chugging along. I have no complaints. It's a little chilly this morning, but, you know, compared to what people in the northern part of the country have to go through, you could still bear going outside in a t-shirt. So no complaints on my end. And like I say, we have reached another Friday. It's always fun to sit down and have our discussions, Sven.
It is. It's always good to talk to you, Grandpa. It was good to talk to Dr. Johnson as well, Matthew Raphael Johnson. And unfortunately, he wasn't here yesterday. And unfortunately, he is still in hospital. We don't know what the problem is with him. It was his cardiologist that said to him that he should go back to the hospital for more tests. As he told listeners last week, he said he went into the hospital last week to have keyhole surgery. I think they went in through his wrists with a tiny microfiber with a camera on the end of it. And they were expecting to find that the ventricles were blocked up. They were expecting to find that it was all blocked up there, and they were prepared to clean them out and clean out the arteries there. But there was nothing there, so they just pulled the camera out and said that there was nothing wrong with his heart. So he's gone back home. He's taken all this other medication. He's been vomiting a lot. So the cardiologist said that he should go back into the hospital. So he's been back in there for the last 24 hours. He told me last night that he was still there. And this is quite a contrast to your experience, Grandpa, because Matt has insurance. So they can take him in there and they can go on this little expedition around his body looking for what's up with his heart and then find that there's nothing there and then send him back home again and then they can get him in again. And of course, each time they do that, they're making lots of money for themselves off of the insurance. And thankfully, Matt has the insurance. He has Obamacare, which he's very thankful for. And I know you've had an experience with American healthcare, and you had insurance couple of years back when you had your issues, and I thought perhaps we could talk about, or you could talk about in particular, what you think of the American healthcare system, because we have two different sides of it there. We have somebody who's got insurance, who gets all these tests where they don't find anything, and then we have you who don't have insurance, and you know, things could be pretty awkward for you if something went wrong with your health, as it did a couple of years back. And I know you had to get emergency insurance and get the Obamacare yourself, but then I know that you stopped doing that, and I was wondering if you could let us know the reasons for that and let us know some of your experiences and what your general assessment is of American healthcare, Grandpa.
Well, this gives us a great opportunity, and we're hoping Matt, you know, gets better soon. You know, first and foremost, obviously, he's, you know, a friend and a huge valuable contributor to Radio Albion, and like I say, a personal friend. So we do hope obviously that he gets better and gets better soon. And yeah, you were telling me about this, and it gives us the opportunity, because a lot of the listenership is going to be in Europe and the UK as well as America. And the American listeners, if we get into the American healthcare system, will just basically be sitting here nodding their heads going, you don't know, because if you're in the UK or in Europe, you know, you don't know very much about the American healthcare system, except, you know, maybe random tidbits that you hear off the internet. So a lot of this might be surprising. Just as an example, you said that Matt has Obamacare. I'm familiar with the Obamacare. Now, when you say someone in America has insurance, so they're able to go do this, what you have to realize is the vast majority of these plans have extremely high deductibles. And what that means is, for instance, when I had the Obamacare, the deductible was, I don't remember because a couple of years, but it was in the range of $6,000 to $8,000. So we'll shoot a dart in the middle and say $7,000. So that means you go one of these tests, just one of these tests is probably going to be in that ballpark. So that means you're on the hook for $7,000 before the insurance pays a dime. This is how they make their money, by the way. And so it's not like when you hear somebody in America, well, they have insurance, so they're good to go. Well, $7,000 is a lot of money for most of us. So you're still on the hook for a lot of money. For instance, I still had the Obamacare insurance when I quit taking the cancer scans because they wanted me to do these cancer scans for like 5 years. And after about two or three, I quit taking them because for starters, the scans are like $3,500 a piece for one CAT scan. And I have to pay that. The insurance doesn't pay anything because you haven't hit that $7,000 deductible. And second of all, the second reason was I'm like, well, we've gone 3 years and nothing has shown up, so I think I'm good to go. And finally, and this will get to another point I'll get to here later in the discussion. Finally, when you go in for these PET scans, they take you in this secluded room where they have this like lead vault thing and they get this radioactive dye and shoot into your veins. And I'm sitting here thinking, if you're worried about cancer coming back, I don't think radioactive dye being shot into your veins is a really good idea. I think that would have like a negative effect. So you take all of those things together. And, you know, I quit taking them. But the point here is when you hear somebody in America has health insurance, that doesn't mean they're not paying anything. It means they're still paying a lot of money. It's just that potentially they won't have to file for bankruptcy.
So it means that Matt's going to have to pay, I guess, $7,000 first every year. And then on top of that, he's got to pay for the insurance as well, before he actually gets any help from the insurance. I think in Britain we call that excess. You have excess, which is the amount that you have to pay before, and then the insurance company will cover all the rest. And this reminds me of when we had Asmodor at Radio Albion. He had health issues as well, and his co-host Ghost had something seriously wrong with him, and they were trying to get donations to help with Ghost. And it's quite alien to me, because in Britain, if you have something wrong with you, you just go to see the doctor gives you a prescription, or the doctor refers you to the hospital, and the hospital will deal with the problem. I mean, you might have a bit of a wait. You might have a 3-month wait if it's cancer, or if it's anything else, you might have a 6 months to a year to wait before you actually get the surgery that you need. But you do at least get it, and then you have the option on top of that. You can always go private as well. You can pay the extra money. And I can remember I've worked for American bosses before in my time, and they always had a private healthcare package as part of the pay. And we always thought, well, what is the point in that? We already have the NHS. We don't need the extra private healthcare. But each of the American bosses that I had was of the opinion that the NHS just wasn't good enough. And of course, that was quite a surprise to me after having been brought up with the NHS and thinking that it's okay. I mean, it's okay if you have something wrong with you, which is a common ailment. If you have something wrong with you and it's an uncommon ailment, then you won't get any help. Also, with like things like testosterone replacement therapy, you can get that on the NHS, but it's absolutely dreadful. They don't actually test you for estrogen. And if you're taking testosterone replacement therapy, that will increase your estrogen levels. You need to measure your estrogen, and you need to take a medication to get your estrogen back within range. And the NHS don't do that. They give you your testosterone, and then they don't even test you for estrogen. They only test women for estrogen. So you get people on testosterone replacement therapy on the NHS who start growing breasts. And the testosterone that they're taking into their body ends up being converted into estrogen. And then they end up getting fatter. And because they've got more fatty tissue, the fatty tissue aromatizes more testosterone into estrogen. And they're into a vicious cycle. And it's wrong, because you then have to go out and pay for the private healthcare for something that the NHS just doesn't do properly. And I understand that from experience. And also things like if you have prostate cancer, the NHS will want to do a biopsy. And in most cases, anybody that has a biopsy develops prostate cancer. Is that linked to the biopsy itself, which is the equivalent of firing a shotgun up there? It fires a couple of dozen darts into your prostate, it tears out the skin, and then they put it under a biopsy and test it, and they'll say, oh, looks like you don't actually have cancer. And then 2 years later, you will develop prostate cancer. So I do recommend listeners of a certain age, don't get a biopsy for prostate. If you have prostate issues, then you should really just measure your PSA reading, which is your prostate-specific antigen region. And if it starts going up, because as you get older, as you get to about 60, your prostate gets larger anyway. And the concern is that it will suddenly get very, very large, very, very quickly, and then you won't be able to urinate anymore. So what you need to do is you need to measure what your PSA is and measure the velocity at which it's going up. If it's out of range, you need to have another few tests every 3 months, get a test done, plot it on a graph, see how fast it's going up. If it's going up at a rate that it's not going to cause a problem until you're in your 90s, then you don't need to go getting a biopsy, do you? But a lot of people panic as soon as they hear, oh, prostate cancer, they panic. They think, oh, cancer, that's the end of it. I have to do everything that the doctor says. And I'm really not very impressed with NHS prostate cancer care at all. So there's two negative things there about the NHS, but the positive side of it is that if anything goes wrong with you, you can go there and just get help. And I think if you had a homogenous country, then that wouldn't be so much of a problem. I mean, it would be a good thing. Nationalized healthcare for the ethnic group, so that we're all helping out each other. But of course, that gets abused, because now we live in multicultural countries. And we end up with asylum seekers being given this help as well, when they really shouldn't get it. And I've got an article on that to get into. But before we get into that, do you want to just respond to some of the points that I just made there, Grandpa?
Well, what you bring up is a point that's relevant, whether you live in a country with a healthcare system like you do with the NHS, or even here in America. And you touched on a really good point that I already actually had jotted down. And that is, if you are unfortunate enough to have to deal with the healthcare system, you know, with doctors on something major, always have an attitude. And I said this when I was going through my cancer stuff: you are the final authority. Don't ever understand, doctors are really good at memorization. And because of that, that's why they're doctors. They get this. If the diagnosis is A, then the procedure is B, C, D. And that's what they're going to do, whether it makes any sense or not. You have to have the final authority. And doctors, depending on the doctors, you know, some doctors like it when the patients get engaged like that and are back and forth. Most of them don't. Most of them are so spoiled to people that will just, as you said, do whatever the doctor says. You know, well, you're the doctor, I'll just do whatever you say. The problem with that is, if they're wrong and, you know, your instincts say that doesn't sound right to me, and it goes sideways, you're going on to blame him. You know, if you take responsibility for yourself and think about it and make your own decisions, your own informed decisions, then if it goes sideways, you're not blaming someone else. It's still a bad outcome, but you're not, at least you don't feel like you were victimized. So doctors are good at memorization, and they're regimented. You know, as an example of what we're talking about here, I've known people who've had a heart attack, you know, who've had heart attacks strictly as a result of medication side effects. You know, you read different medications people are taking, and, you know, possible side effects could include, you know, a heart attack. Well, this person was on a medication that had one of those side effects. It could cause a blood clot, which could cause a heart attack. And that happened to this person. They came through it just fine. All was good. They took them off the medication. What was funny is the doctor insisted on putting them on all of these blood pressure and cholesterol medicines, even though their heart attack wasn't from blood pressure or cholesterol. It was a heart attack from a side effect from a medication through a blood clot. It didn't matter. The doctor insisted on putting them on these cholesterol medications, even though their cholesterol is fine, because they're regimented. You know, well, this is what we do. You have a heart attack, then we put you on cholesterol, we put you on blood pressure medicines, even though it has nothing to do. So you have to always be willing to take control of, you know, and when they say, well, this is what we do, you have to say, why? And you start asking and questioning. And you have the final say. It's your body. They're not your boss. They're not going to take, if they're wrong, they're not going to take responsibility. It's on you. And, you know, it's your body. That's the ultimate responsibility of taking care of, you know, of yourself. So, yeah, that's a point that's relevant, I think, Sven, regardless of what kind of healthcare system have. Your doctor is not the final authority. You are. And you should always have that attitude, you know, and ask, you know. And if your doctor doesn't like you and bows up because you're asking questions, get a different doctor, because it's your life. It's literally, because some of these medications they want to put you on just as a matter, because this is what, and when you ask them, and you'll say, well, why do I need that? And they'll give you answers like, well, that's what we always do. That's not an answer. That is just telling me what your regimen is. And that's what makes doctors doctors. They're good at memorization. They're not necessarily smart. They're not necessarily, you know, experts beyond the fact that they've really good experts at memorizing the procedure. If this happens, then this is what we do. As far as stepping back and saying, well, in these circumstances, that may not be the best course of action. Maybe we should do this. Some of that stems also from the fact, and I'm not going to delve off into it now because we're going to keep rolling. We may come back to it. In the U.S. now, doctors are basically employees. Back 40 years ago, you went to your doctor. He was probably in business for himself. He ran his clinic, because everything with these insurance companies falls under HMOs. Basically now, most doctors are nothing more than employees of some sort of healthcare corporation. And as such, they're following company policies and procedures. And the policies and procedures say, if this is the thing, this is what you do. They don't even have the freedom anymore to say, yeah, that doesn't make any sense. We're not going to do that, because they are basically, they're answering to the organization that they work for. And like I say, we may circle back to that if we get a chance. We may not. But yeah, we'll keep on going, Sven.
Well, their hands are tied. It's the same over here. I guess it must have been since the Harold Shipman murders. Up until that point, we used to be able to pick and choose which GP we wanted, which doctor we wanted. If we got on well with a doctor, you would stick with that one doctor. You'd have the same doctor for your whole life, of course, which makes sense, because they learn everything about you. They know everything about you. But since Harold Shipman killed lots of his patients with morphine overdoses, they said, well, no, we can't allow this to happen again. So you can't stick with one doctor for your life. You have to variate the doctor. You have to be seen by every doctor at the GP surgery. And of course, this causes problems, because not everything is going to be written down. Also, what they actually write down is considered to be an established fact, as if it was a finding of a court. That's what courts are there for. They establish facts at a trial. What gets established at the court, that's the way that things are. And it's the same with doctors. What doctors write in their letters are established facts. So if they do make an error, it's very, very difficult to get them to correct that error, because the only way they can correct it is to follow on from that error. They can't say, oh, well, that was an error, that was wrong, because that's an established fact. Even if it is an erroneous fact, which isn't actually correct. I mean, I've had issues with trying to get diagnoses put right, and it's been very, very difficult after things have been missed quite some years ago. and you only get 2 years as well in which to make this challenge. If you do feel that a doctor has got something wrong, you need to make that challenge within 2 years, because if you don't, they won't accept it. They'll say that it's gone on for too long. We can't possibly find that all out, all the details out. And you have access to your records as well. You can do a subject access request, and you can get copies of all of those letters, which I recommend people do. If they're having anything to do with healthcare, you need to keep records of what is being written down about you. And you also need to have a look at your medication, particularly the patient information leaflets. I had a blood test the other day. That's something else that I recommend that people do at least once a year. Have a full blood test, get all your bloods checked. You're entitled to that, really, on the NHS. Just go there and say, I'm a little bit concerned I'm putting on weight, or I'm a little bit concerned I might be low in testosterone, and get a full blood test and check everything. I got a full blood test the other day. I actually got a private one, and it said that my cholesterol levels were slightly out of range. So I left it a few months and got another one, and again, they were still slightly out of range. So I saw the doctor the other day, and the doctor said, we'll put you on these statins. And they checked everything. They checked my body weight, looked at the blood results, which I showed them, checked my age, checked my height, asked me about my diet. And then they gave me these statins. And I thought, right, well, okay, this is cholesterol medication. I got back home and I had a look at the cholesterol medication, and I had a look at the patient information leaflet, which I say is very important. All sorts of awful side effects that can come about from taking these statins. And it says, first off, try changing your diet. And if the diet doesn't work, changing the diet doesn't work, then the last resort is to start taking the medication. So I thought, well, I'm very glad I read this patient information leaflet, because that's what I'll do. I'll change my diet first and then get another blood test in 3 months' time. And the doctor didn't say this to me. The doctor didn't say, well, maybe try changing your diet. And that's because the doctor has to do what is prescribed for them to do. If somebody comes in and says, I've got this issue, they have to give them medication for it. If they hadn't given me this medication for it and I had a heart attack, they would have been in trouble for that. But I feel it's better for me to change my diet slightly and eat a little bit less than to actually start this medication. And just as a final point, as I was saying about how you're not able to actually see one doctor all your life now, you have to change. I also was talking to a GP a couple of years back, and she was saying that it used to be that they used to be able to chop and change with the medication. Of course, doctors see a lot of elderly people, and they would give out the medication to the elderly person, and it might not work. So they would give them something else. It might be something else that's not even related to the ailment. And the old person might come back and say that medication worked really well for me. You gave it to me for my chilblains or whatever, and it worked really well for my rheumatism. And the GP would then be able to prescribe it as an off-label use because it worked well for that person. But they're not allowed to do that anymore. Not allowed to do that at all. They're only allowed to prescribe specifically what they've been told to prescribe. And they have a way of checking that with statistics. I forget what the actual word is. But it basically means they have to have studies shown that the majority of people will respond well to this medication, and then they have to give it to them. Even if it doesn't respond well to you and you go back there and say, well, this isn't working, I'm getting really ill from this, that's the only thing that they can give you. They can't actually give you anything else. They can't give you these off-label uses anymore. So there are more and more restrictions in healthcare that make life difficult for doctors. As I say, I certainly don't blame the doctor I saw the other day for writing me this prescription, because that is what they're supposed to do. But what you should do is always have a look at the patient information leaflet and always look into whatever your diagnosis is so that you can find out as much about it as possible. Do you want to comment on that, Grandpa?
Well, we fight here in America. We fight with the doctor. It's kind of the same thing. The difference is there with the NHS, you know, it's the government approved, you know, they have to do, this is the procedure the government says. Here, everything is about getting approved by the insurance companies. So it's the same thing. It's just a different It's just a different authority thing. And I'm glad you looked into that, because statins, if you really start doing some research, so statins, however you say it, that's one of their go-to prescriptions. Here in America, I don't know how it is there. Here in America, they write prescriptions. If you're over, say, 45 years old, you're probably going to get, and you go to the doctor, they're going to try to put you on these things. It's just a matter of course. They're incentivized because by the pharmaceutical industry. This is all, I always would tell people, it's called the healthcare industry for a reason. It is about making money. It's not, you know, it's not a humanitarian thing. It's not a philanthropist endeavor. It is called healthcare industry. Never forget that. It is about money, and you are the source of the money. Now, in related to what you're telling, similar experience, you know, and like you pointed out, this is what I was saying. You're in charge. You don't have to take anything they give you. You don't have to agree to any procedures. You are in charge. It's your body. It's your health. You bear ultimate responsibility. If you get it wrong, that's on you. Don't go crying about it's the doctor's fault. Make your own decisions and live with that. The statins, they're very, you really get into some research on it. I read some stuff on it sometime back. I don't have it. I'd send it to you to look over if I still did. But in actual research, they're like 3% effective. And like you said, they have a number of side effects. I have a personal a story related to what you're talking about, doing your own research. When I had my first cancer surgery, when I went to see the oncologist after the surgery to follow up with them and start seeing the oncologist, one of the first things he recommended was this immunotherapy, I think is what they called it. And I said, well, what does that involve? He said, well, you ought to come in every week or every 2 weeks, and we give you an IV. It's $1,200 a pop, by the way, for these IV sessions. But he says, you're past your deductible on your insurance, so it's all good. Won't cost you anything. He says, and it really will help lower, because the type of cancer I had the first time, it is one of those, if they get it all, you're good to go. If they don't, it's going to lodge in your organs and kill you within a year. I mean, it's super aggressive. So, but he says, I really recommend it because it lowers the chances. If that gets in you, if they missed anything in the surgery, it'll lower. You know, he was selling it to me. In other words, he was selling me on this immunotherapy. And he obviously expected me to say, yes, let's do it. And I said, I'm going to have to think about that. We were fresh off of COVID and putting these vaccines, these mRNA vaccines. And I'm just, I'm skeptical. I have to think about that. So he gives me the literature, says, think about it. When you come back in 2 weeks, tell me what you decide to do. I go home and I'm looking at this because I asked him, okay, well, how does it work? You know, you're telling me, you know, how does it work? And he says, well, it tricks your immune system into seeing any cancer cells as a foreign, substance and attacking it. Your immune system attacks it, which is a pretty layman's vague description. And that kind of raised a red flag with me. So I take up the literature and I go home, and I'd already was at 60%. I'm not doing this. And I look through the literature, and it basically doesn't give me any more information besides this is what it does. But as always, you get to the back. Possible side effects could include, sometimes when they give you this, your immune system simply decides all of your organs are foreign substance, and it will attack your organs and cause serious illness, coma, blindness, or death. Needless to say, when I went back after 2 weeks, I told him, I ain't doing that shit. I'm not doing that. And he hemmed and hawed and was kind of taken aback, because again, these doctors are used to everybody just becoming helpless. People go to the doctor, especially if they're facing a healthcare crisis, and they become children and the doctor's their daddy and whatever you say. And when you take control of your decision making, they don't know how to deal with that. And he was kind of taken aback. I said, I'm not doing that. You know, just simple as I'm not. I don't have to give you an excuse. I don't have to justify my decision. I'm telling you, I'm not doing it. And he hemmed and hawed for a while. And then after a while, he said, well, it does only improve your chance, like, 15% or so. He said, if it was a huge percent, I would argue with you. But since it is basically 15%, okay. And we'll move on. Yeah, I'm not rolling the dice on, it could shut all my organs down and kill me on the off chance that, you know, that this happens. So, yeah, no, it's, it just really, I can't make the point enough. Always have the attitude that you're the one in charge of the ultimate. You're the final decision maker when it comes to your healthcare. I want to circle back real quick because I think we're going to get away from it, and we kind of already have. But a point that bears making, because we're talking about the Obamacare here, you know, when we opened the show. Another thing, like with the Obamacare, when I got it, it was running like $900 a month. The government was paying that in a tax credit. I think they've discontinued that. I'm not sure. However, what you get into is if your income is over a threshold, and it's a pretty low threshold, they bill you back for more and more of that. Now, are you going to pay this is why I don't have it. I'm not going to pay $500, $600, $800 a month for insurance that literally isn't going to pay anything. They're not going to pay out anything unless you have to go in the hospital. So you're betting against yourself. Because if you just got to go to the doctor, if I have to go to the doctor and, you know, do an office visit, I'm not sweating that. I can pay that. You know, it's not an arm and a leg. People act like it's not. It's a doctor visit. Just pay it and go on. Where you get into trouble is if you have to go in for surgery. If you have to go in the hospital, then, you know, then you're getting into real money. Paying the kind of money this health insurance costs, you know, on the off chance that what if, now, I'm not going to pay $800 a month. I'm not going to pay $500 a month. I'm just not. I'm just not going to bet against myself and just, you know, go with what I, you know, hopefully I don't get into an accident. But that's just the reality. And the system here in the U.S. it is beyond broken. And people in America know this because the cost of it is just unsustainable now. And it goes up every year. You know, and then 40 years ago, if you had health insurance, you didn't pay anything. You went to the doctor, it's free. If you had to go in the hospital, it was free. It didn't cost you anything. And then they started adding deductibles. And now, like I say, we're at a point now the deductibles are like $8,000. Well, they're not paying anything. And they're charging $800, $900 a month for this stuff. So, yeah, I'm sorry I kind of circled back and got off. But if people, if you're in Europe or the UK and you hear, oh, well, people on Obamacare, that's government insurance. It doesn't cost them anything. Yes, it does. Unless you're just really, really poor. You know, or you make very little money, is going to cost you. And see, I think the tax credit that was covering that, I think they've done away with that because that was part of that shutdown they had at the end of 2025. They were arguing over that. And I'm not 100% sure, but I think they've done away with that altogether. And people, if so, then people are going to be getting some really steep bills for insurance that at the end of the day, unless you have something catastrophic happen, isn't going to pay anything. But I'm sorry. I know I kind of backed up and got into that, but it's just, again, if you're in Europe or the UK, you don't really understand how these things work in America. You hear that, but they have insurance, so it doesn't cost them anything, but it, believe me, it does.
So the Obamacare doesn't mean that everybody now has insurance in America. It means if you're extremely poor, you might have that insurance, but if you're on a low wage, you're not going to have that insurance because it's going to end up costing you so much money that you're going to have to pay on top. And also there's this big excess, the deductibles, as you refer to it there, Grandpa. And the word that I was trying to think of was evidence-based prescribing. That's what they go by now, evidence-based prescribing. And that doesn't mean the evidence that a medication works for you or the evidence that you don't get side effects from it. No, what it means is they've tested this medication out on 100 people, and the results they got from that are exactly what this medication does, regardless of it may affect you in a completely different way. They may have just given this medication to these 100 patients and only give it to them for a week. You might have been on that medication for 10 years. You might have no side effects from it. But if the test patients that they gave it to for a week and 100 of them got side effects, then they'll say, well, these side effects are going to be a problem, so we can't give you that. And that's a new thing, this evidence-based prescribing, as I say. But it's not evidence that it works for you. It's evidence it might work for somebody else. But everybody is different. And this is why this GP was telling me that she used to try out different medications on her elderly patients. If one didn't work, they would try another one. They were all sort of fairly similar from a class. And eventually they'd find one that did work for the patient, but she's not allowed to do that anymore. So their hands are tied. Well, anyway, if ever you do get anything wrong with your grandpa, all you would have to do is just come over to Britain and they'll give you free healthcare. As we learned this week, even if you're an illegal asylum seeker, you will get free healthcare, especially if it's transgender treatment. This article I've got here comes from GB News. Transgender migrant given sex change treatment on the NHS without a right to remain in Britain. A man from the Philippines received a sex change on the NHS while in the process of applying to remain in the UK. The Filipino migrant had entered Britain several years ago as a man, but underwent gender reassignment surgery to become a woman last year. Home Office immigration papers changed his titles from Mr. to Miss after surgery. The patient posted a celebratory message on social media under a new name, a feminine version of the old one. He received free consultations and care at London's Chelsea and Westminster Hospital, which is bound to be an upmarket hospital in Chelsea, where 40% of the patients there miss their 18-week treatment target. So they actually have a four and a half months target that people actually get seen by. The Filipino patient received the surgery, however, at a private clinic. The surgery is believed to have cost in the tens of thousands of pounds. So the NHS paid for them to go private, basically. Whereas the Indigenous British people, they end up missing their 18-week treatment target. And this is another issue. As I pointed out earlier, if you need testosterone replacement therapy on the NHS, you'll have difficulty getting it. And they won't measure your estrogen, they won't measure your prolactin, they'll just give you the testosterone, never mind the fact that it will make you grow breasts or it will make you obese. However, if you're female, they were extremely keen to give females testosterone. If they were claiming to be transgender, they were so keen that they were actually giving it to children. Of course, that has now stopped, but they're going to be doing another study into that, which we covered on the Daily Nationalist a few months back. But the difference in the way that men's healthcare issues are treated in the way that women's healthcare issues are treated, I mean, it is a huge difference. I mean, women laugh when you talk about the menopause, but men end up losing their testosterone, the same as women end up losing their estrogen once they get to a certain age. And it affects men in exactly the same way that it affects women. They get hot flushes, they get brain fog, all of these issues. It's just that with men, the testosterone gradually slows down. You gradually get less and less of it. Whereas with women, their estrogen just falls off a cliff straight away. With men, it's just a little bit more gradual. But one of the problems that we have now is healthcare tourism. And you have people coming over to Britain from the third world with all sorts of issues, particularly AIDS problems from Africa. And when they get to Britain, even if they're an illegal asylum seeker, an illegal immigrant, they will still get the healthcare. They'll still get all the expensive HIV medication. They will even get a taxi to the hospital. I've got some more quotes here, if I can find them here. Between 2024 and 2025, Britain spent £744 million on the services branded a catastrophic waste of money. That's on asylum seekers receiving taxpayer-funded social care. Days earlier, it emerged that 168,000 migrants aged 16 and over were enrolled on taxpayer-funded English language courses over the same period. The government has moved to shut down some excessive spending on overseas arrivals. A ban on asylum seekers using taxis to travel to doctor appointments came into force last week after taxpayers were hit with a £15 million bill. In one case, an asylum seeker was found to have charged the Home Office £600 for a 250-mile trip for a medical. Last year, it was revealed £15.8 million was being spent each year just on taxi costs. And never mind them getting taxis to doctor's appointments, when they actually get there, they get preferential treatment as well. Because if you are considered to be homeless, they say, well, homeless people have difficulty getting to the doctor. They often have lots of things wrong with them. So if they do ever arrive at a hospital, we have to make sure that we see them and we give them all the tests that they need, which effectively means that if you're an illegal immigrant, you're an asylum seeker, you will go straight to the front of the queue when you get to the hospital, because they will reason that you will probably have lots of things wrong with you, and you probably won't have been to a hospital for a long time, or never if you actually come from Africa. So they'll put you to the front of the queue. So you can see that these are the sort of problems that we have with an NHS, the sort of problems that we really shouldn't have if the government didn't allow these illegal immigrants into the country in the first place. And I very, very rarely hear of white people coming over to Britain, so just so that they can get treatment. But I should imagine it would be possible to do, Grandpa, if you did ever get cancer problems again, God forbid. I certainly hope and pray that you don't. But if you did, you might want to take a little holiday over to Britain and come and see your old pal Sven Longshanks and take a visit to the hospital while you're here. Any thoughts on what we just had to say there, Grandpa?
They wouldn't let me out of the airport. You know, I wouldn't even bother, because I mean, as soon as I stepped off the plane, you know, they'd grab my passport and that would be that. So I don't think that's, I don't think that's going to happen. Now, I saw a story years ago. God, this was like 20 years ago, you know, because you're talking about the tourism and like 20, 30 years ago, the dollar was a lot stronger. And there were people even then doing this, not going to Britain, forbid. But it was an in-depth news story. It was on a mainstream news network back then. But there were people that, like, for instance, had to have heart surgery. And they were told, you know, this is going to cost you $100,000. Well, they would go to some place such as Singapore and pay out of pocket for like 20 grand to get the exact same surgeon, or I'm sorry, the exact same surgery from doctors who'd been trained in the exact same schools. The rooms were like first class hotel rooms, you know, better service, better food, better everything for a fraction of the price. Dollar's a lot weaker now. I don't know if you could actually do that. Now, you do bring up a good point, because you know, these things work both ways. And that's kind of one of the things I thought was really good about the idea of doing the show, is so that people on both sides, whether you live in a country with nationalized healthcare or in America, you know, because people have these illusions of how these things work. Americans will sit there and say, oh, see, that government healthcare they got doesn't work. They don't understand the problems. There are problems, and you've really hit on a big one. See, I don't think national healthcare, like with your NHS there in Britain, there's nothing wrong with the system, but it cannot function when you're bringing these outsiders in. In other words, if you didn't have this immigration policy that you've had for years now, the people that live and work there pay into the plan, and as they're paying into the plan, it pays for people that are having to get coverage. It works. You know, the problem is when you start bringing in tens of millions of people who haven't paid anything into the plan, they're never going to pay anything into the plan. It was kind of like when Merkel was saying they're bringing all these people into Germany to pay the pensions. It's a meme at this point, and it's laughable, and they're not even making those claims anymore. Nationalized healthcare, like the NHS, fails because you can't bring all of these outside people in who've never paid anything into it and are never going to pay. That's what kills the system. If you have no immigration or virtually no immigration, and you have like a closed system, and the people that live there pay in, and the people, you know, it can support itself and it can work, and there's nothing wrong to it. You're always going to get into, you know, problems with the government bureaucracy and things such as that. But as far as just across the board, like Americans will do, condemn something like the NHS as some, you know, that's just socialist communism and that don't ever work. Well, yeah, it can work. You can't bring in, you know, the entirety of Africa and expect it to work. No, but it can work if the conditions are right. The conditions aren't right. And that is a definite consequence of, you know, the immigration, how it taxes that. Now, here in America, you know, another funny thing, bringing that up, you know, Americans will sit here and scoff, you know, they got that nationalized health care there and it doesn't work. But in America, if you're over, once you hit 65, you can go on Medicare, which is basically government health care. It is the NHS for old people. You go on Medicare, now supposedly all this paying into Medicare your whole life, this helps cover. You still have to pay out of pocket, but it's generally going to be reasonable. I always find it funny when somebody who's on Medicare in America will sit there and be like, oh, at least we ain't got that national health care like they got in Britain. It's like you're on Medicare. You are on national health care. You're still going to see a quote unquote private doctor, but you're counting on the government to make those payments. So yeah, it doesn't exactly ring true. We're kind of in this whole thing here where they know the costs are unsustainable, but there's so much profit motivation. No one's going to fix it. You know, here in America, it's, you know, it's just not going to be fixed. And I think the answers lie somewhere in between personally. For instance, I think Mexico has a pretty good system. In Mexico, if you don't have any money and you have something go wrong, you go, the government covers it. Now, yeah, when you're in recovery, you're not going to be in a nice private room. You're going to be in an open ward, in a bed lined up with all of these other people, but you will still get seen and you'll still get, you know, taken care of. You know, you're not going to be staying in a nice private room and all of that. You're eating the same food as everybody else, but you will get seen. If you have money, you can pay more and get a private room. So you have that option. So it's not just, well, I can just go ahead and die because I can't afford to pay for this versus, well, I'll wait on a list for a year and maybe I won't die by then and the government health care will take care of me. They have kind of an in-between system. And I think that's better than what we have here in America because it is hard to emphasize enough how broken the entirety of the system here is. There are people, it is a regular occurrence here that there'll be people be in a car accident and they need to go to the hospital and they'll refuse the ambulance ride because it could cost tens of thousands of dollars for a 10-minute ride in the ambulance to the hospital. They'll just say like, no, I'll have somebody come pick me up and hobble myself in there. I mean, every aspect of it. And you were talking about these drugs. I wanted to circle back to that. This is a topic I can obviously rant on. We could go on for hours, but you know, you were talking about the drugs, the studies, earlier, Sven, and COVID, as I said, COVID was a real eye opener for a lot of people, myself included, because people started really looking into that. And you have these drugs, and it turns out, you know, because Americans forever, we thought, well, it's got to be more or less safe because it's FDA approved, right? You know, the FDA, the government agency, has approved it. And we thought for our entire lives that FDA approval meant that they submitted the drugs and the FDA did their own research and made sure everything was safe and lined up before it was approved. Only we've come to find out now that no, the pharmaceutical companies do their research, often very slanted because they've invested a lot of money into these drugs and they've got to get them to market. There's a huge profit motivation here. And they just simply hand the research to the FDA and say, well, these are the findings we made. And the FDA basically rubber stamps them. So you're not getting FDA approval. You're getting pharmaceutical companies who have already invested a lot of money in these drugs. You have pharmaceutical company approval. You're just trusting the pharmaceutical companies. The FDA is just rubber stamping this stuff. I don't even know why we have them because it's just window dressing. They're not doing any research on these drugs at all. It's the pharmaceutical companies. And again, with the COVID stuff and the vaccines, a lot of people got to looking into this and finding out that the research, the pharmaceutical companies, like if they have research that shows, hey, this is really bad and could harm people, they just basically bury that research and only produce the ones that says, yeah, it's the greatest thing. Greatest thing since sliced bread. Your best bet is not to get sick, not to get hurt. Hope that everything works out because It's really, it's like the legal system. You don't want to get involved in it if you can help it, because it just opens up a whole can of worms. And oftentimes the outcomes could be very, very bad.
Well, I am encouraged to hear that you do at least look after your old people and you have Medicare. That is encouraging to hear. But I think the British healthcare system is really going the same way as the American healthcare system. We used to have opticians, dentists, all of that was provided free. Opticians now, you have to pay for your glasses. You get a little bit from the state to go towards it, but you have to pay for the rest of it yourself. Dentistry, that all used to be free. Now we've got so many people in the country that we haven't got enough dentists for them, and they can't afford to pay the dentists either. So everybody pretty much has to pay private, or they have to wait on a waiting list for a couple of years before they can see a dentist. And of course, COVID-19, that just completely destroyed, decimated the dentist, basically, because nobody was able to see a dentist for 2 years. And when they came back, after not seeing a dentist for a year, you get struck off from the NHS list as well. So everybody then had to re-sign up to try and find an NHS dentist. They had one in Bristol, I believe, last year, and there was literally queues going, a mile-long queues, for about 3 days long, where people were just queued up trying to see a dentist because you can't see a dentist. And people end up going to places like Turkey to get their teeth done, or Poland, where you can get your teeth done for about 10% of the price that it costs you in Britain. I mean, although in Britain on the NHS, you will be in a ward with lots of other people in it, like you were describing there, Grandpa, at hospital in Mexico, you do have the choice to go private, where you would get a private room, but it's not actually provided by the NHS. It's provided by a private healthcare company. So it's not like you get a two-tier system at the NHS. You can pay a little bit more and get better treatment, a room to yourself, or not pay at all and be on a ward. You have to have private insurance with another company before you can get the private ward. And also, when the NHS doctors and the consultants, they say, oh, you've got XYZ wrong with you, you're going to need this surgery, this operation, we can do it next year in March, or you could pay money now and you could get it done next week privately. So we already have that in place. So I do see that we have problems on coming on the way from the healthcare system in Britain. But as you point out there, Grandpa, I mean, the main cause of these problems with the system is too many people. And that is a fault of the government's immigration policy. And as we see here, even the people that have no entitlement to it whatsoever are even being given things such as gender reassignment surgery, which must cost thousands, tens of thousands of pounds, if not hundreds of thousands of pounds. I mean, why should somebody be entitled to that comes from the Philippines, that just arrived here a couple of years ago illegally? And that's just one of many, I'm sure, as we can tell from the costs of sending these people to the hospital by taxi. And then when they get there, they just walk straight to the front of the queue in front of all the white people that have been waiting there for the last 18 hours to see a doctor. So although we do have lots of problems with the healthcare system in Britain, at least we do have a healthcare system for everyone. And there is that safety net there. It's just that it is being abused. Grandpa, have you got any final thoughts on everything today before we wrap this up?
Oh, I like I said before, Sven, I can go on for hours. I mean, we could make this a half a day long show. We're not going to, obviously. But like I say, it's hard to exaggerate how broken the system is here in America. You know, and let's say nationalized healthcare has its problems primarily because you can't have outsiders come in that have never paid into it and start drawing it. That is your primary, what I see from the outside looking over there with these national healthcare, whether it's in Britain or one of these countries in Europe. There's nothing wrong with the fundamental idea, but you can't bring people in who've never paid into it. I mean, that's just basic arithmetic. That's not real hard to figure out that you're going to destroy the system. And I don't see a bright future for the NHS over there, because you can't bring all of these people who've never paid in, and they're never going to pay in. It's just going to, you can do the math off the top of your head on the back of a napkin and figure out real quick that you're going to bankrupt the system and it's going to collapse it. Yeah, here in America, the system is broken and it is also going to collapse, but for another reason, because you just get to the point. And because what we're both discussing here, Sven, is two-tiered systems, even over there or over here. I always used to tell people America's the best healthcare in the world if you've got money. You know, if you don't, you're out of luck. And it's apparently very much kind of, and it's going to be more so the same over there. You know, if you have the money to pay for it, it's another form of two-tier system. We have two-tier justice, and you have and you have a two-tier healthcare system, because it's very similar. If you get into any legal problems, if you've got a lot of money, you're in a lot better shape than if you're a poor person. You're just kind of at their mercy. So yeah, it's broken. Both systems are broken for different reasons. Like I say, the affordability here is completely unsustainable. You're just gonna get a point to where people just literally can't go, and then what? You know, at some point in time, the whole house of cards in either scenario is inevitably going to come crashing down.
Well, there are lots of other topics we could have gone into. I mean, we didn't even get anywhere near the subject of restriction of access to pain relief, which we could probably do a program just on that one subject alone. Perhaps we will do that at some point in the future. And of course, we wish all the best to Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. We wish him a speedy recovery, and that the doctors find out what's wrong with him while he's in hospital. We hope that he's out of hospital for the weekend. If he's not, I will let you know on Monday. Thank you very much for coming on today, Grandpa. Thank you very much to listeners for listening. I will be back on Monday with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.